Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at QuickenLoans.com/NSS.
Google Home gets hacked. The security-focused operating system, Cubes OS, and Megan gets trained to fight like a Jedi. Live from the Twit Eastside Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
And this is episode 84 for December 17th, 2016. 1 week till Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, yeah.
2 weeks to New Year's Eve.
Yeah. Exciting.
Celebrate the party of your choice.
That's right. I'm celebrating with my Christmas tree.
Aww. That's really cute. In fact, it's so cute, I think I better Snapchat
you
that.
You better.
Wait a minute. Let me just put the snap spectacles
Send
on.
It to all of your
and
Snapchat
record
friends.
That 10 seconds of. It's not.
It's not blinking. It's just LEDs and a battery. Come on. I had 10 minutes. Give me a break.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I got snap spectacles. I'll talk about that in a second.
Lovely.
Other news stories. 1 billion user accounts were hacked on Yahoo a couple of years ago. So this is, add this to the half billion.
Yes.
If you were hacked before, were you probably hacked again?
Probably.
That's terrible.
By somebody else.
Who knew that there were even a billion people on Yahoo? The one thing I would say, we said this last time, don't delete your Yahoo account. Mm-hmm. I would be tempted to, right?
Because
I'm mad as heck. Don't delete your account. Keep your account because you don't want somebody to use your account against you. But probably delete sensitive information if you can.
Yep.
Names, passwords, unencrypted data, a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. They can't catch a break. I feel bad for them.
Really? You feel bad for them?
I feel
bad for us, people who used Yahoo.
That's true, too.
I mean, because after all, you got to... Now, they had a very good... I'd be very curious to see what their security guys say, because they had a very good security team. But remember, the guy in charge of security at Yahoo quit around this time, saying they're not taking security seriously enough. He was mad Marissa Meyer wasn't sharing... If he found out about the original hack, wasn't sharing that with him. He moved on. I'm trying to remember his name. Very well-known security guy. Anyway, nice. Yeah. What more can you say?
What can you do? Man.
Evernote got a little trouble earlier. They announced a new privacy policy, and buried deep within the privacy policy a line that said, don't worry, your data's safe. Okay, employees could access it. But we'll only do that under, you know, because... We really have to,
right,
or something.
Right.
People got upset, and Evernote backed down.
They backed down. I mean, rightly so. I mean, nobody wants this. You could have private information in there. There could be all sorts of things.
I should point out, however, here's what they say: after receiving a lot of customer feedback expressing concerns about our upcoming privacy policy changes, Evernote is reaffirming its commitment to keep privacy at the center of what we do. I would like to point out that Evernote, like most cloud service providers, has the key to your encryption.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what they say in that statement, a rogue employee could look at it. And if they got a subpoena from a federal law enforcement, or actually any law enforcement, they would have to honor that subpoena and hand it. And they could hand it over.
And they could.
But Apple can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Most cloud can, because in order to make the cloud convenient, they kind of need access to that data and deduping and things like that.
That's right.
I would just say, if you have private stuff, you know what I've been using? I mentioned this before. I've been using Synology. Mm-hmm. They have, if you get the Synology network attached servers, and they have a variety of different ones, but they have a really good, their software is excellent, DiskStation, and they have a very good Evernote replacement called a disk station note sharing or something like that, disk station note. And it imported all my Evernote stuff. It actually used OAuth to do it. It logged into my Evernote account, grabbed everything. If it's encrypted in an Evernote, you'll want to decrypt it first and then have it sucked over. But now it's stored on my cloud.
Right.
And I can delete all my Evernote data. This is what I'm going to end up doing.
Yep.
Stored on my cloud. I have access to it just like Evernote on everything. It has syncing. It's really good. Does everything Evernote.
Yep.
Note Station is what it's called.
That's a great way to do it, you know, kind of automatically, or you don't have to mess with it. There's also,
right.
You can roll your own on a Raspberry Pi.
Sure.
Roll your own cloud and do it that way as well. Maybe that's for more advanced users, but there are lots of ways out there that you can get similar services in your home or privately as you can publicly
right.
with the
We've mentioned OwnCloud and the fork NextCloud.
Mm-hmm. Yep, NextCloud.
Those will run, both will run on a Raspberry Pi or any Unix-based
yeah.
or Linux-based
yeah,
operating system.
Any of them.
I like Disk Station because you get they have good security policy. They have, for instance, two-factor authentication. I'm really enjoying it, and it's doing everything I want it to do, mm-hmm. including images and all that
wow.
stuff. So there are a few things from Evernote you might lose.
Like, and fairly simple to set up.
Yeah.
Like. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right, let's talk about the spectacles. So Snapchat is so smart because they did not give these to reviewers,
uh-huh.
right? You had to figure out where they were going to sell it. And initially they were selling them like they were announcing a pop-up vending machine.
Right.
One was in Big Sur. They were all over, you know, in obscure remote places. They finally opened one in New York City. And at first you had to wait in line. Christina Warren famously called herself a a-hole for doing it. She waited in line 5 hours to get one and felt bad about it. Since then, they've set up appointments. They're open every night through Christmas Eve. And what happened as a result, I did not go to New York City to get these, but people have been getting them and selling them on eBay for a somewhat lower price. So I got this at a buy-it-now price of around $200, which is about a $70 premium.
Oh.
For me, that was worth
it. That's not bad.
Yeah, if you really have to have them. I'm not a big snapper. But
I'm not a snapper.
I kind of like these. So, oh, you've got some. Anthony, this is me this morning getting out of my car. So it's a first-person view. I've read some things that suggest you put your hands in the shot once in a while just to remind people that it's a first-person view, not just a camera, right? Look down at your feet, things like that.
You've got Ozzy there.
I've got Ozzy. It's kind of, there's John waiting to let me in, as he does, because I'm usually very late. And you can maybe see them. And so if you follow Leo Laporte on Snapchat, I posted a bunch. See, if you look down once in a while, then you can see what's going on here. Actually, these are pretty well designed. I was impressed. You can download lower resolution stuff, downloads automatically to your phone via Bluetooth. And if you want the full resolution the camera is capable of, you can do that, but you have to do it kind of manually. It uses Wi-Fi to do that. Here I am going and sitting down. So this is all from this morning. And you can do all the things, the Snapchat things, like add icons mm-hmm. and text. And I didn't bother to do that just to demonstrate it. It records for 10 seconds. Here, show the snaps again. So the camera is here. And it's a pretty decent camera, as you can see. And this is a light that lets you know. So when I press this button here like this, you'll see the light comes on. That lets people know that I'm recording. And then it goes for 10 seconds per press. You can press it multiple times. And then blinks a few times in the last few seconds. It's blinking. I can see it blinking. You can't. And before it stops, so you know that it's ending.
So that's stored in the glasses?
It's immediately copied over.
Okay.
Well, that's a good question.
Is it
recording to the camera?
First,
no, I think
right?
it's storing it in the glasses.
and then
I'll show you if I can show Alex. Here's some memories. This is kind of neat, too, because... this is Lisa. I'll turn on the sound so you can hear it talking. And when you rotate, see, I added the eyeballs there.
Yep.
When you rotate this, So when you look at, if I post this online on Instagram, it'll be a circle, right? Because that's what it's recording, a circle. But when you rotate your phone around it.
Oh, that's cool.
I think that's kind of cool,
that
right?
That is. I like that.
Yeah. It's a very immediate way of recording. I have to say, I didn't expect to think much of these. I was buying it so we could talk about it.
Yeah.
I've been using them a lot. We went to Vegas last couple of days. And I did something there. By the way, let me just show you. I did at the very end. You know, suddenly you're looking at the ceiling. That's because I thought I was done, and I put them on my head. So you may notice in my snaps every once in a while, I seem to spend a lot of time looking at the ceiling. That's because I did that. This is the other thing that's cool.
That's funny.
They come with this case, which is a hideous case, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a variety of colors, but I got black. But the case actually charges the snaps. So this is kind of cool. There's little pogo pins in there, right? Huh. And the spectacles hide the pogo pins behind the hinge.
Nice.
So you don't see them. So there's no USB connection. You just put them in there. The light lights up to say, I'm charging. And this will charge it four times. It has its own USB cable that it comes with pogo pins to charge
it.
And you can see the current state of charge by pressing that four means fully charged. So you can easily get through the day on this. I think this is actually the industrial design.
This is better than I thought they were going to do. When I heard about this, I thought it was going to be more of a gimmick.
I thought it was all gimmick.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's actually really...
Now, you used Google Goggles or Google Glass.
Google Glass. I bought Google Glass for $1,500, so $200 didn't seem so much to me. These are, I think they're normally $129 if you go to the pop-up store.
And how would you compare them?
Well, this is completely different in one respect. It's the same as the video part, which is for many was the compelling part of Google Glass. Mm-hmm. But there's no display inside it. I can't see anything. I can't get notifications. Nothing like that. I can't listen to music. The only thing this is video cameras. We've seen temple video cameras and stuff, cameras built into glasses before. But these are somewhat cool. I was surprised. You know, I'm walking around the casino with them. I don't think the awareness is there yet that these are cameras. Right. They just look like ugly sunglasses.
Strange glasses. Look at that guy.
But at the restaurant, one of the waiters said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I explained to her what these were." And she was kind of baffled, but somewhat interested. I think she was going to throw us out, but we already had spent so much money that she decided, okay, I guess. But you should be aware if you wear these of privacy concerns and implications. Right. I kind of like this. It's funny, my kids, Henry, who's 22, uses Snapchat. My daughter, Abby, who's 24, said, you know, I'm a little too old for Snapchat. Mm-hmm. I never got into it. She just missed it.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
My kids love it.
Yeah, I think
they're teenagers.
I get it. I actually get a little bit more now because everything you share on here is impermanent. It goes away in 24 hours.
Yep.
So it's just a way of kind of staying in touch with people and friends. So I'm public on Snapchat. If you want to view my snaps, you can see only the most recent 24 hours worth, though, right? It rolls off.
Right.
So I think the first snap on here is the last thing I did yesterday, 24 hours ago. Snap spectacles.
Pretty cool.
They're getting a little more available now. That was like the cool thing. Well, I got jealous because Trey Ratcliffe's daughter was here last week and she had them. Can't let that go by. No. So we are a maker. I love Aaron Newcomb. It's always great to have you. And you build stuff like that Christmas tree.
Yeah, why not?
And
actually, I'll tell you it's a secret about the Christmas tree. It looks a lot better if you take gumdrops and cut a little slit in them and put them over the LEDs, the little sugar-coated gumdrops.
Yeah, they'd sparkle.
It looks great. I went to the drugstore to get some, and they were sold out. I was going to bring them.
Probably a lot of people building Christmas tree LED displays.
Little secret for all those makers out there. If you want to jazz up your LEDs, just
thinking, what else you could put on there that would have that same effect?
Well, you know, you can buy actually 10 millimeter LEDs diffused.
Bigger ones,
twice as big. These are 5 millimeter. And those look pretty festive as well.
But if you wear it on your lapel, which is kind of cool.
Why not?
Yeah.
And all
Wouldn't
I did,
be hard
look,
to
the,
make
look
it
at the back of this, Alex, since you got it. All it is I tied all the positives together, tied all the negatives together,
made sure
I wasn't shorting it out there in the middle. Put a little battery on it. That'll last for, I don't know, 6 hours, 7 hours, something like that.
And you could blink if you put a little blinker on there.
You could blink it. You could actually hook all of those up to an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi.
Something a little more sophisticated.
Or you could build a circuit with a 555 timer and hook it up that way and have them blink. All sorts of stuff.
We brought the Google Home out. Actually, this is yours.
Yep, that's mine.
Because you have been doing a little hacking with this as well.
Yes, I got one of these as soon as I could because I'm really interested in home automation and I've been really excited to see what Google's going to do with it. They've had several attempts, you know, the Nest thermostat, all this stuff. But when they came out with Google Home, they said, well, this is going to be integrated with if this, then that, and all these other things like Alexa is. And I thought, okay, this is the ticket right here. This is what I want to use to automate my home. So I got one for that, and I've been playing around with it, and I thought I'd bring in some things to show you what I've been doing.
Amazon's Echo works with the SmartThings hub and the Wemo hub. A lot of hubs already out of the box.
Yep.
Does the Google Home work with any hubs out of the box?
It does. In fact, they just announced this week they're going to be supporting – they already supported SmartThings. They supported Philips Hue.
Okay.
And they announced they're going to be supporting Wemo and a bunch of others.
So this is cool because you can control a lot of stuff with this already.
And this week they just released their API for this as well. And they announced updates to what used to be called Brillo, that's now called Android Things, as well as Weave. So you can actually download Android Things and run it on a Raspberry Pi and start, if you're a developer, if you want to start working on that, you can start working on that now. But if, like me, all you want to do is control a few things, a few light switches around the house, you don't want to go spend a lot of money, again, like me, cheapskate, don't want to go spend a lot of money on Philips Hue bulbs and things like that, you can actually drive them yourself with either an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi. It's pretty
easy.
So
this would replace the hardware that you got the Google Home.
Yep.
It's going to talk to these directly?
It's going to talk, well, you can
talk to
it directly.
If this, then that.
It's going to talk to if this, then that.
Got
That's
it.
The way I do it because it's a lot easier.
Right.
So you can set up a REST, or they call it an applet now, and if this, then
so
that.
On one end, the applet will have a connection to Google
Yes,
Home.
Right.
And that's built
that's
into
the
if
this.
Then that.
Yep, the this is Google Home. If you say this to Google Home, if I can show you what it looks like. Do you want
to
take a
look? Yeah, let's see it. I can put it up on my
I've got
screen.
It up on mine here.
Oh, okay.
If Kara's got my screen.
Do you care?
Yeah, there she is, right there. Perfect. So this is Applet Maker, and this in Applet Maker, when you go in here, sign up for an account, click on this, and you can search in here for Google, and you'll see Google Assistant right there on the screen, and then you can set it up to do a couple of different things, a simple phrase or a phrase with a text ingredient or a phrase with a number.
This is pretty – can Amazon Echo do this? Or no, this is pretty sophisticated. I'm intrigued by this.
I do not know because I don't have an Amazon Echo.
Yeah, let me
look that up.
Yeah.
So you can say open the garage door, for example, and then you can give it a couple different options of how to say that. And then you can tell the recipe to respond to you. This is what I like. You can say, I want Google Home to tell me this in response. So we can say, no problemo.
So you're actually writing a script to talk.
Garage door. Excuse my spelling there. We'll just say that. So that's it. That's the trigger. And then for that, and here's the important part, you have to go to the Maker channel.
The only thing I can find on If This Then That with an Amazon Echo is when and I actually use this, when a timer goes off on your Echo, your phone will get a notification. This is much more sophisticated. So,
it is.
You know, it's interesting because Amazon really has a head start with Echo. There's 5,000 Echo skills now. But this means anybody can write a simple skill right there in If This Then That for the Google Home.
Yep. And all you really have to be running for this, I'm using the Maker channel. So, you know, I'm running a web server on both of these devices, both the this is actually an ESP8266 programmed through the Arduino IDE. And then Raspberry Pi, of course, is running a little Python script that is a web server as well. But that's basically it. You just do those two things. And as long as you have the right ports open through your router at home, you might have to use port forwarding on your router to get those ports through to these devices. But as long as you have that set up, then you can start making requests through Google Home, and it'll actually go through and trigger these devices. You want to see what it looks like?
Yeah. I might be wrong on the Echo, by the way. I think I was looking in the wrong section.
I'm sure chat room will tell us here in a minute.
So looks like you can do more stuff with an Echo than I thought. I was searching for Echo. You have to search for her name.
Oh, yes. Don't say it.
Her name.
And by the way, we're about to trigger this thing, so hit the mute switch on your Google Home devices.
This is getting to be a bigger and bigger problem because so many people listen to our shows on these attached devices.
Yeah.
So mute your Google Home now.
Right. Turn off your
phone,
whatever it is, because we're gonna trigger it. So here we go. So let's try the Raspberry Pi. I have this set up to an LED, a little simple little LED here, and this could be.
Yeah, I was wrong. The Echo will do a lot of these.
It will do.
Same
I thought
things.
It
yeah,
would.
Yeah,
I thought it must. Because they're a little bit.
I was searching
along.
For the word Echo, not her name.
That so let's try to trigger the LED. Okay, Google. Turn on my lights.
Okay, I switched the light on the Raspberry Pi.
Oh, nice.
See, so it turned on. Okay, Google. Turn the lights off.
Okay, I switched the light on the Raspberry Pi.
So there it goes. So it goes on and
That's
off.
That's very simple.
Now, this could be hooked up to a relay that was then hooked up to your actual lights in your room. So it actually could be, because all this doing is triggering a signal, right, to this LED. But that signal could be attached to a relay device that's actually switching the AC power in your home.
Yeah, this is just a proof of concept. You could see that if you could switch something on and off, you could do almost anything, right?
Right, yep, exactly. Yeah. So then we could also trigger this one. This is also running a web server, so we could trigger this one. Can you see what that says?
So the Echo can do what we just did.
Is on there.
It says the new screensavers.
Okay, Google. Open the garage door.
No problemo. Opening the garage door now.
Right. So now it says garage open, right? So I'm just, again, we can't really open a garage door here in the studio or trigger anything to do that. So I just programmed this little LED.
Show me the recipe for that.
Yeah, sure.
If this then that. So we can see kind of how you would program it.
Yeah, so let's go back here. This is the actual recipe. Like I said, you search for Google. Whoops. Go back a couple more steps.
Okay, you already got this.
I already got that. So this is the this, right?
So you want to say the trigger phrase, open the garage door.
Right. And when you hear, and you can actually program in other ways,
optional ways,
right?
Yeah.
You could program open sesame. How do you spell sesame? S-E-A-S. Open it.
Spell it phonetically.
Yeah. There we go. Open it. You can even say another way, right? So depending on how, three different ways to say this, it'll do the same action.
Oh, and you told it to say no problemo.
And I told it to say
and
no problemo.
Opening.
No problemo. Opening the garage door, right?
But you can have it say anything you want.
You can have it say whatever you want. Yeah. You can say, yeah, you're my master, or
yes,
right
master.
Away, sir, or whatever you want. It'll say whatever you put in there. And then for that, you have to subscribe to the Maker channel.
Aha.
And what the Maker channel allows you to do is send outgoing web requests. Come on, Maker channel. Oh, it's thinking.
So the Echo, Dr. Mom is telling me she's done a lot of this stuff. The Echo can do it with smart home.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very neat.
Yeah. In the Maker channel, you can set up an incoming or an outgoing request.
The Maker channel does it by IP address? How does it know?
Yep. So here it is. You set up a URL web request, right?
Okay.
So you, like I said, there's a web server running on both of these devices.
Got it.
And you set up your web request, and you can have a custom page, for example, or you could have a form field that you're filling out automatically with this web request. And then once that goes through, of course, you've got your program running on these devices that triggers whatever you want to happen. And you can do, from that point, you can do whatever you want. You can trigger relays to go off. You can trigger strings of LEDs to blink and do all sorts of fun stuff.
That's kind of neat that it's using a web get.
Yeah,
a
simple,
or a post.
It's simple, right?
Yeah.
At least for people that have been in IT or they know technology, this is the simplest way to do it. Really.
So you have Apache running on your Raspberry Pi.
It's actually LightTPD.
LightTPD,
because it's lightweight, right?
Yep.
That's running on the Pi. On the ESP8266, they have a built-in web server library that you can use in the Arduino IDE to make that run.
Okay.
It's very small, very, very, very lightweight.
And then the server sees the GET request.
Mm-hmm. And does whatever
and parses
you program it.
It
to do. Yep.
And you program that how? In HTML? Or?
So the ESP8266 would be done in the Arduino IDE, which is C++.
Okay.
I used a Python script on the Raspberry Pi because that's easy.
But they have the hooks for turning on lights and other things.
Yeah, you're basically just controlling the GPIO pins. Set that GPIO pin high or low or whatever you want to do.
Well, I have one of these at home, and I have a couple of Raspberry Pis, as many people I know watching do, lying around. And I can't wait to play with it.
Yep.
Hey, an update, by the way, on the Google Wi-Fi that we talked about last week. I was able to get it working. It was one of the units was kerfluggered, and I kept getting the same error message on the phone app. I tried, and it said, you know, call us. So finally I called him, and the guy told me how to reset the Google Wi-Fi device. Maybe this is somewhere buried in the documentation. There's not much documentation. In fact, as I remember, it's more like an IKEA instruction with just pictures.
Right.
But if you press, there is one button on those Google Wi-Fi devices. If you press and hold it as you plug it in, as one would almost expect from a router, it will reset it. It re-downloaded its firmware. Hmm. So it really kind of refreshed itself, and then it worked just fine.
Oh, good.
So there's an update on that. That solved the problem. I was able to put it all together, and everything worked. So I had a bad unit, I guess, is what happened.
Cool. I should say, Leo, before we move on, you know, shameless plug, all of this stuff that I've just been talking about will be in my book, that's coming out next year called Linux for Makers.
Oh, nice.
So if you're
Where will we get that? Is that Make Magazine doing
Make
that?
Make Magazine, yeah. So online, Barnes & Noble.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Whatever. Just FYI.
Oh, that's great. Well, we'll give you a big plug when that comes out.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Benicia Makerspace, you probably can go in there and say, hey, Aaron, show me how
to do that. We've already had one class on this, actually. Have you? A bunch of people wanted to know how to do it. So I said, oh, I've done that. Here, let me show you.
One of the questions we get an awful lot is, how can I be on the Internet completely safely, completely privately? Mm-hmm. We've shown a number of solutions, hardware firewalls. We've talked about various versions of Linux. But one of the things we haven't done before, and I'm really excited about this, is talk about cubes. Q-U-B-E-S, the Cubes OS. Andrew Wong is going to join us in a little bit. He is the community manager for the Cubes OS project. And we're going to get a tour of the Cubes OS. This is really interesting because everything in the Cubes OS runs inside a virtual machine. Mm-hmm. So even if you got something bad, it's completely isolated from everything else. It's completely firewalled off. I love this idea. And also, we're going to go down and learn some lightsaber techniques. I'm excited about this from the Golden Gate Knights. But first, a word from Rocket Mortgage. Big fan of the Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage was created by Quicken Loans, the premier mortgage lender in the country, for people like us, geeks. People who don't want to go into a mortgage loan situation to buy a new house with boxes, banker boxes and folders and paperwork. We just want to do it all online, right? That's kind of the way of the world these days. We want to do it all online. Rocket Mortgage put the entire mortgage approval process online, whether it's to buy a new house or to refi. Watch the video on the website because it's kind of cool. This couple's going around. This happens. You're there at an open house. And they're just looky-looing, but all of a sudden they go, you know what, we should buy this. And before they leave, they go online on their phone and they go through the process. Just a few questions. You could submit pay stubs and bank statements with a push of a button. You don't even have to get up from your couch. Do it on your phone, your tablet, your computer. And the big point is it turns it around so fast. You're going to get approved in minutes, and it's for a tailored solution just for your financial situation. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. It works. Now, one of the problems with this business is still some old-fashioned stuff because you still have to sign papers at the end when you're buying the house. But I love this. Rocket Mortgage actually sends a notary public to your house with the papers and sits down and does it with you. Wow. For Rocket Mortgage, go to quickenloans.com/NSS. quickenloans.com/NSS. They're an equal housing lender. Of a license in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. Rocket Mortgage. Go to quickenloans.com/NSS for more. So I was wondering, I saw this lying around here, and I thought there must be something going on here. And I put it on. This is the Stormtrooper helmet, the white Stormtrooper helmet from the original Star Wars. Do we know what vintage this is? But after I put this on, I realized why in none of the Star Wars movies can the Stormtroopers ever shoot straight. You can't see a darn thing in here. No wonder they keep getting beat by the Jedi Knights. We sent Megan Maroney to the Golden Gate Knights to learn the techniques of lightsabering. Watch.
I am Megan Maroney, and I'm here in San Francisco with the Golden Gate Knights. Every Sunday, they get together to teach people the art of saber choreography. I brought my boys with me, and we're going to check it out. So is this your first time here?
Yes. Super excited.
Have you ever done any choreography or with sabers?
No. Yeah. I just mess around with wooden sticks.
Yeah. And did you make your costume? It looks beautiful.
I did. Thank you.
Oh, my God. His costume was so awesome.
No one heard that.
No one heard that.
I'll show you the darkness, cameraman.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you all for coming. We hope today to teach you a little bit about the fight between Kylo Ren and Rey. All right. So, how about this? We're just going to warm up a little bit with our saber. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I'm tired. This is hard work. I had no idea that the force was so aerobic. I am burning a lot of calories on my Apple Watch. But unfortunately, there's no workout for saber choreography.
And 4. Good job, everyone. Give yourself a
What do you think so far?
It's fun. Yeah, it's like Jedi yoga.
I'm having so much fun. I didn't know how much exercise there was. So you get this workout, too.
Yeah.
I feel good after all of that.
We're going to start now with just some basic techniques that will get us through the first phrase, the first part of this choreography.
Guard position, cue with the pommel, and cut.
I'm here with Alan Block, one of the co-founders of the Golden Gate Knights.
Hello.
How did you get involved in this, Alan?
Well, I was really interested in costuming, but there was not a lot of people that were doing reenactments. So I decided that I wanted to learn. So I met a man named Matthew Caruto, and we founded the Golden Gate Knights about 6 years ago.
Stepping back, just like this.
What's your martial arts background?
My martial arts background consists of French foil. I also know how to do some German longsword from Lichtenhauer School. And I also know how to do Bolognese side sword.
You come here, and jump back. Good.
You also perform.
Yes. In fact, we've performed with orchestras such as the American River College Orchestra. We've also performed with an orchestra here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Temple Hill Orchestra. Just recently, we had a performance over the Academy of Sciences for their Star Wars thing.
There you go. Now the ball, now the other side. All you're doing is bringing it across.
What exactly will someone learn when they take one of these classes?
They're going to be learning theatrical stage combat.
A little bit higher than that.
Good. Not a martial art, but a performance art, so they can look like they're fighting. It's actually a really great thing to do friends or bring in a date. People come here, they don't know really anything about performance, and we teach them how to become a really cool performer and sort of live out their childhood fantasy of being a Jedi Knight or perhaps a Sith Lord.
You killed my father figure!
So if someone wanted to take this class, what would they do? Where would they go?
They can come to our website, goldengateknights.com, reserve a space. You can also check us out on Facebook, where we post a lot of events, and simply sign up. We take a $10 donation, that's about it, and over a course of time, when they become really good, they can perform. We do that for charitable events.
If someone doesn't live near San Francisco, how can they learn these techniques?
Well, there's a lot of groups that are starting to do this, starting to teach stage combat.
All right, everyone, let's all come forward in a big circle.
There's one national group called Saber Guilds, and they have chapters all over the country, in fact, across the world. And they do a lot of good charity work as well. I'd say just jump on the internet and just start Googling around. You'll find them. They're actually a lot more common than you might think.
May the force be with you on the count of three. One, two, three.
May the force be with you.
Wow, that's cool. Do you have to provide your own lightsaber? Oh, we're ready. Did you see this?
One.
We've got the special. This is like the fancy Kylo Ren lightsaber. Look at that. That could, you could hurt yourself. You could poke your eye out with this. This is
and
dangerous.
Several other people's eyes as well at the same time.
I would definitely. If I had that, I would definitely hurt myself. What fun. Golden Gate Knights. You can find out more at their website, which...
Just Google it.
Why? Oh, I'm talking. You know what I'm doing? I forgot I was Snapchatting during that. Let me just send that Snapchat. Thank you, Andrew Wong, for being so patient. He's been hanging on for an hour now, and I really appreciate it. He's the community manager for the Cubes OS project. Thank you for your patience, Andrew.
Thanks, Leo. I'm glad to be here.
Are you an attorney?
I'm not.
You look like you're in a law office, right? Very fancy office.
I'm actually a graduate student in philosophy.
Nice. You're a philosopher.
Oh, nice. So
who would have thunk it? Who would have thunk it? But yeah, I might have some geek roots if you're doing this.
I think I do.
tell me a little bit about the genesis of Cubes OS, Q-U-B-E-S. Where did it come from?
Well, it actually started almost 7 years ago, and this is before I was involved. So originally, Joanna Rutkowska founded Cubes OS, and... My understanding is that, you know, she needed a desktop operating system that would meet her own security needs, but there was nothing really available that met her requirements at the time. So she invented Cubes OS. She's the idea is, yes.
She's a Polish computer scientist who is quite well respected. So I think her need is something that we all share somewhat, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. So Cubes OS is a bit Linux-based, right?
It's based on currently it's based on Xen, the Xen hypervisor, and Linux. The work is in place to replace potentially Xen with a different hypervisor or replace Linux with other operating systems for use in the different components. So at this point, Cubes is almost to the stage where it's kind of its own thing.
So we've seen Linux operating systems, Linux distros aimed at security. We've seen actually Unix operating systems, because I think also of OpenBSD aimed, and NetBSD aimed at security. I'm thinking of Tails OS. But this is a little bit of a different take on it. I installed it. Actually, it's very easy to install. It's a lot like installing any Linux, where you download an ISO. I put it on a USB key. They have instructions on the website. And then I happen to have a Dell. This is the Dell Ubuntu Developer Edition laptop from 2013. And, one of the nice things about the Dell laptops is because of their Sputnik project. There's good drivers in general. Linux runs very well on Dells. No problem installing it at all. I presume it installs on a great many PC-type hardware systems, right?
So right now the biggest hurdle is actually hardware compatibility. It can be hard to find a laptop that's compatible, but we keep an HCL, a hardware compatibility list, that can show users which laptops work well with Cubes, and it's not too hard to find one, but you do have to keep Cubes in mind when you're shopping for a laptop.
In general, if Fedora 23 works on it, will it work?
In general, yes, but there are certain requirements since Cubes requires Xen. Take a look at the system requirements. The main requirements would be if you're using an Intel processor to have VTD and VTX, since you can get a lot of good the main security benefits that way.
That's hypervisor support in hardware, right?
In the chip itself, in the CPU, right? They have that supported. What about just overall performance of this thing? I mean, if you're running a lot of virtualized environments on top of essentially a guest OA or the primary DOM, as you say, isn't this going to take a lot of hardware requirements, CPU and memory and all that? Or could you get by with a, let's say, lackluster laptop or system?
You can get by. So, of course, there is a noticeable performance. There is a noticeable performance overhead compared to just running a bare metal operating system, but it's not too bad. So, the main thing is that you're constrained by memory and how many different VMs that you can run at the same time. Also, it's nice to have a fast SSD, just because you do have to read, at a few different levels. But I would say overall, at this point, the performance is pretty good for laptops that you can realistically get.
This seems to be working quite well. This Dell is an i7, 8 gigs of RAM, smallish SSD, 256 gig SSD. It was probably very high end 3 years ago.
Right.
But this is probably commonly the kind of hardware people install it on. Mm-hmm. Now I want to understand what's going on. So you use the phrase hypervisor and DOM, and I want to step back a little bit so you can explain the dummy here. Every program I run on Cubes, in fact, I'm running right now Firefox, a control panel, and I see a manager, a VM manager. Everything is running inside its own individual virtual machine. Is that correct?
So you don't necessarily run every program in its own virtual machine. Instead, the way that things are divided or compartmentalized is according to what we call security domains. So the idea is that you take your digital life and you can divide it up into different parts, like personal, work. You can create a different domain for whatever you like, and then you can run your different activities and store your data in those different domains. So you could run more than one program in a single domain if you wanted to.
So I see here, I've got, this is the default setup. I mean, I literally just installed this, and I have installed XFCE is the desktop manager. You can install other desktop managers, but this is a good lightweight one for a lot of hardware. And it's pre-installed with a variety of domains. There's as you mentioned, personal and work. There's a vault domain. What's that for?
So the vault domain is... the idea there is that you can basically make a kind of network isolated or air gapped machine for use with a password manager, for use with storing really sensitive information or documents, basically something that you want to not have any networks access and not have any other VMs be able to copy files or text into it.
Ah, great. Untrusted would be where I would do stuff, what, that might cause trouble. But again, it's isolated, right? It's
right.
If I installed spyware, malware, adware in Firefox running in this untrusted domain, it couldn't then spread to my other domains.
Exactly, right. So, you know, if you have to browse, you know, just the open general web and you're worried about drive-by downloads or things like that, then you would use the untrusted VM. And then, you know, if one of the sites that you visit happens to be, you know, serving you malware through its ads or something like that, then you don't have to worry that your personal and work domains are compromised.
And it's a simple enough thing to delete the domain and recreate it. If I do get a compromised untrusted domain, I can just erase it.
Yep, you can just remove it and create a new one right from the Cubes Manager. You can also back up your domains. So all of that functionality is built in.
I realize one of the things I didn't do yet on this one is set up the Wi-Fi. Ah. So that's why when I tried to browse nothing, it still says connecting.
Nothing's coming up.
I literally just installed this before the show.
Literally, as you're walking in, you're still installing it.
So when you say DOM, is that what you mean, domain? Is that what you're saying? It's short for domain?
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
Right. So in Zen lingo, DOM is short for domain. So DOM 0 or domain 0 is basically what we're looking at right now. That's the kind of control domain where you have your GUI and you have all of the windows from different domains on a single desktop.
So even the desktop manager is running in a separate domain, say, from my Firefox here.
Exactly.
Wow.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
there's a very special reason for that, which is that we want the desktop manager and the window manager to be in the most trusted domain, in DOM 0, because that way we can prevent a compromised domain from attempting to spoof Windows. So you know, you might be worried that if an untrusted domain gets compromised, then it might try to pretend that it is your entire desktop. It might, you know, make itself go full screen and then just say, "Hey, I'm your desktop. Interact with me and tell me all your secrets." Right.
Yep.
So if we can prevent that, then that's a really desirable security feature, and that's one of the central things that Cubes bring and that it was designed to do.
How about saving state? If I go and use Firefox in one of these domains, or DOMs, as you, and then close it and go back, is it gonna know all the things I did before? Is it a continuous state, or does it wipe itself each time?
So there's two kinds of domains. There's ones that are permanent, and then there's ones that are disposable.
Uh-huh.
So the permanent ones do save state, and it's just like having, you know, a computer within a computer, and it functions the same way. But if you open a disposable domain or VM, then once you close it, it's completely destroyed and it's, you know, gone forever.
I noticed there is an unusual domain here. It's Anon Hunix. What is that?
Yes. So Hunix is a project that allows you to use Tor more safely by separating the Tor process from applications that use Tor, like Tor browser, into separate VMs. And at this point, Cubes and Hunix have become integrated so that you can use Hunix VMs within Cubes seamlessly. So at this point, you can have a what we call a service VM or a proxy VM that can allow you to connect up your whatever VMs you like and then have all their traffic be forced over Tor. So you can do this to download all of your updates for Tor for the entire Cube system. You can use it to, you know, use Tor browser or use any application you like and have it go over Tor. And then you don't have to worry that if there is, say, a zero-day exploit for Tor browser that causes it to become compromised, you don't have to worry that the attacker will then be able to learn your real IP address or compromise the Tor process because it's securely isolated in a different VM.
All right. So, okay. Can I install arbitrary programs within one of these domains?
Yeah. So it's you can do whatever you would ordinarily do inside one of those VMs as if it were, you know, that distribution or that operating system.
So it's just and that explains why you have these templates down here.
Right.
There's a template for Debian 8, for instance. You mean I would, in a sense, run Debian packages within a DOM that is dedicated to Debian? Is that exactly what that is? Or
pretty much, yeah. So the way the template system works is that you can have different templates for different operating systems, and you can even have more than one for the same operating system if you have more and less trusted templates. And the system is that each of your VMs can use a template, and it can get its root file system from there. So instead of having to install an entire operating system into each different VM, you can instead just install it once into a template, and then you can base as many other lightweight application VMs or app VMs on that template as you like. So this saves on disk space. It saves on all sorts of resources. It means that it's much easier to update, since you can just update one template and then have that update applied to all of the app VMs based on that template. And the way this is set up is, of course, you know, with security in mind. So things can only go in one direction. Your app VMs can't, they only have read-only access to the template. So an infected app VM can't infect the template. But the other way around is true. So the template is a much more trusted and sensitive thing than the app VMs based on it.
What about containers?
Like Docker.
Yeah, like Docker. I mean, we talk a lot about that on the shows on the Twit Network. Why not use containers for this? It seems like using Xen for this would take up a lot more resources than just using containers.
So I'm not an expert on containers by any means, but one of the really nice things about the Xen hypervisor and other bare metal hypervisors compared to containers, and also compared to what are called type 2 or hosted hypervisors, is that with Xen, it's a relatively small, that is thin, you know, low number of lines of code, small layer that's sitting right on the hardware, and then everything else runs on top of that. So in that sort of setup, in order for an attacker to subvert the entire system, they would have to be able to break out of the hypervisor or somehow compromise the hypervisor. By contrast, if we're running hosted or type 2, hypervisor, then we have a larger, you know, more bloated operating system, and then everything else is inside of that. And my understanding is that the situation is going to be the same thing with most containerization technologies. So in that situation, you know, it's still better than having everything being in the same monolithic environment. But the problem is that if the host operating system gets compromised, then everything else goes down the drain too. So, for example, if I'm running Windows and then I install VirtualBox or VMware or Docker inside of Windows, and then I have different VMs or containers inside of that, then if that main Windows installation gets compromised, then the whole thing is compromised too.
Interesting. Yeah, so you have a huge vulnerability there in that system, because you want to protect your host operating system, of course. I really like how everything is separated here.
Yeah, I mean, if I do a terminal, if I do ls in my personal DOM, I see only files in my personal DOM, and then I go to a terminal in the work DOM, I see only files in my work DOM, and there's no inter-process communication. It just doesn't. I'm not going to see anything there. It's almost like different accounts, right?
Yeah.
Unless you want to transfer files between them. So there is functionality allow these to be integrated. So there's a few different ways. The main way is that if you have a file, you can just open up, you know, the file manager and then right-click. And then in your right-click menu, there will be an option that says copy to another VM or move to another VM. And it's the same. It's a similar process with copying and pasting text. So there's an inter-VM clipboard, and the default shortcut is just Control-Shift-C to copy, and then Control-Shift-V to paste.
Now, isn't that's a potential security vulnerability, because if I can move data from one VM to another, couldn't malware do the same thing?
Yes, that's very true, which is why it's very important for users to understand, you know, what it is that they're moving and the risks associated with it. So by itself, there's no way for a compromised domain or malware to trigger this kind of move.
Right. You can only do it because you're in the primary
domain.
You're in the zero DOM, right? So you can do that there. But if you were in these subdomains, there's no way that you could get access to that functionality. You're kind of in jail there, so to speak.
I get it.
Right. a compromised VM could request the transfer, but then you would get a pop-up in DOM 0 that is unspoofable and unforgeable asking you to approve it. And, you know, if you didn't trigger that, then of course you wouldn't approve it. So that's the functionality there. It basically puts all the control in the user's hand and says, you know, we trust you to know what's in your best interest and, you know, to be as secure as you want to be, basically.
That's the tough balance in a secure operating system is you can make it secure and then the user goes, I can't use this at all.
Password, that's good enough for me.
So, and then, that's the opposite is, of course, the user can do anything they want. They can run it as a root if they want. So this is really impressive. It's still, though, very geeky, right? I mean, this isn't aimed at
as
an average user yet.
It's not. So we're working hard to try to make it more usable for mainstream users. But you're right. Right now, it's very geeky. It's anyone can use it if they want to. I mean, I didn't have any prior Linux experience or anything like that when I started using Cubes. I was just a lifelong Windows user. But, you know, I wanted a secure operating system. And there was a learning curve, certainly at first. But if you are someone who, you know, wants this or needs this and is willing to go through that learning curve, or if you're someone who is already familiar with Linux and who is a tech enthusiast, then, you know, it's you're probably going to be able to pick it up and find it very usable.
Yeah, I mean, the Linux part is pretty straightforward. It's the idea of these different domains running at the same time and which domain to use. But I've only been using it since the show began, and I'm getting kind of the idea of all of this. Have you guys been audited? What are you doing to establish through an independent party your security bona fides?
Well, so we would certainly love it if anyone were willing to audit.
It's always a good idea, but it's open source, right?
It is. It's completely free and open source. All of our code is on GitHub. You can, feel free to download it. We haven't had an official audit yet. I think, it's hard to find qualified security researchers who are willing to put in the time and effort to do that sort of thing for free. We have recently launched a new commercialization and community funding effort. And the idea here is that, we think that a lot of corporations could really benefit from the security that Cubes provides. So we are offering licenses to corporations, and at the same time, we'd like to continue the open source development of Cubes. We're basically asking the open source community to support us to the extent that they are willing, so that we can continue to do that.
And of course, Joanna Rutkowska is very, very respected in the security community. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is her effort here is highly respected and trusted. So it's not like this is out of nowhere.
No, and Zen itself is a very, well, I should say old. I mean, I was using Zen when I was at Sun Microsystems like 10 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an open source project that's been around for a long time.
Right.
And in fact, powers a lot of the virtualization engines that people use, right? I think like Oracle VM and a bunch of others are based on Zen, right?
Really?
Yeah, a lot of the cloud runs on Zen. And, many of the major Zen vulnerabilities that have been found over the years have been found by members of the Cubes team. So I think at this point, the main sort of pedigree is, what the team has done in their previous work as security researchers.
Mm. Very, very interesting. And going forward, where do you plan to take Cubes?
Well, so, like I said, we're making the push toward commercialization, and we're currently working on version 4.0. So that release is going to bring a lot of big changes. The main one that most users will be seeing and will hopefully find helpful is that the VM manager, the Cubes VM manager that you see there, is going to be kind of decomposed, and those functions will be spread around to different parts of the desktop. So it should be much easier to interact more in a more natural way with the different domains that you use. And, of course, other things will come along with this new release, bug fixes, better hardware support, things like that. So we're really looking forward to the release of 4.0.
To give you an example, when I was setting this up, it asked, do you want to set up a sysusb domain? And I wasn't sure why I'd want to do this, so I asked Andrew, and this is you know, we know there's a huge problem with plugging in, you know, stray USB keys because of bad USB. It's very, very risky to put a USB key. So this literally isolates the USB key and the interface from the rest of the operating system.
Yes, exactly.
That's I can see why people, you know, somebody like Edward Snowden. Is Edward Snowden using this?
He when he endorsed us a couple months ago, he said that he uses CubesOS.
Wow.
Yeah.
He says, if you're serious about security, this is a tweet, CubesOS is the best OS available today. It's what I use and free, and nobody does VM isolation better. Wow. That's a pretty good
endorsement.
That's from September. That's that's about as good as it can get. This is really fascinating. And I have to say, what it is a great proof of concept. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Joel Spolsky on Triangulation on Monday, Joel on software, and he said, I thought by now we would be, all our software would be running within a virtualization or a container isolated from other software. Mm-hmm. That was the idea of, you know, the sandboxy, a lot of, you know, that's how Chrome works, right? In theory, is it isolates each tab. Mm-hmm. But this seems like a really strong, robust. And by the way, easy to install. Now, I had to put my laptop in legacy mode. It's a UEFI laptop. Yep. Is there a UEFI install for it, or is it only a legacy mode?
There is UEFI support. Okay. Depending on the hardware that you're using, you may have to try one or the other.
I was just
but
lazy.
Both should be supported.
Would it be more secure to use UEFI? Would it matter?
So I don't think that there's an appreciable security difference from the sort of Cubes mindset because basically when it comes to boot security, we rely mostly on what's called anti-evil made. So the idea is that if something in your boot process is compromised or malicious from the get-go, then there's nothing we can really do about that. But if it's not, then you can at least use what's called anti-evil made to protect yourself, to be alerted if an attacker tries to change something in that boot process.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if the system is already compromised, well, all bets are off.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Anti-evil made.
Is that a program? What is anti-evil made?
Yeah. So anti-evil made is a program. It's a function in Cubes that protects against so-called evil made attacks. And evil made attacks are basically what they sound like. So, say you leave your laptop in your hotel room while you're on a business trip.
And the evil maid comes in, changes the bed, and changes your boot sector.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So your attacker, you know, bribes a maid to go in and then plug in a USB stick and press a button, and then now, you know, you're compromised straight from boot, right? Because for the most part, you're going to have something that's unencrypted, right? If not the boot partition itself, then the BIOS or something. And so if there's nothing to check that and to make sure that it's the way that you left it, then when you enter your disk decryption passphrase, an attacker could potentially get that. So that's the evil made attack, and anti-evil made can protect you against that, not by preventing it, but by alerting you if something like that happens.
Yeah.
And that requires a TPM, a trusted platform module.
So there would be an advantage to using a secure boot system, as long as the secure boot system doesn't require you running Windows.
Exactly. Right, like it does in most cases.
As it does in most cases, unfortunately. Yeah. Wow, this is really cool. People could find out more online by going to the website qubes-os.org. Find an old laptop, download it, and try it. I feel fairly comfortable. Now, is there a root user, or is Dom Zero have a root user? I noticed that I'm not a root user. I'm just a regular user.
Yeah, there's not really any root user separation by default in CubesOS. And there's the reason for this, and it's somewhat controversial in the community, but the reason for this is that from the perspective of our development team, that doesn't really provide you much security. Mm-hmm. So all of your user data in your VMs is going to be accessible from the user account. And from DOM 0, it doesn't really make sense to have user root separation because if an attacker can get into DOM 0 at all, then it's already, as we say, game over.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. This is great. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you going to be, what kind of philosopher are you going to be?
My specialization is epistemology and ancient philosophy. Nice. I work on something called Pironian skepticism.
Wow.
I'm all over Pironian skepticism, let me tell you. I don't believe that for a moment. No, I'm just kidding. Hey, Andrew, really nice to meet you, and thank you for putting out the word. I hope everybody who's watching will download Cubes. We you know, a lot of our viewers, like me, love playing with Linux distros, right? Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting Linux distro.
Try it out. Yeah. It's certainly different than any other one you tried.
And, you know what, XFCE, you'll be very comfortable with the environment. Yeah. You'll be able to move around. It's kind of cool. You see all these different DOMs that you can work within. And try it with Tor. And I have to say, I don't feel a lot of lag or overhead in this.
Right,
it's pretty impressive.
As you've been moving through, I've been watching.
Yeah,
and
it's pretty responsive.
None. Yeah, very responsive.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate your time. You spent a long time with us, and I'm sorry we kept you on hold for so long.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
I really appreciate it.
Andrew Wong from Cubes. We got to put the word out. And you know what? I can see it at a place in time. You could take this, underlying it, and do something like Google did with Chrome OS on top of Linux. You know, put a browser in there, and nobody has to know what's really going on, right? You just have maybe different menu commands for different levels of, you know, this is my personal workspace, my workspace,
and never the two shall meet.
Yeah. Yeah,
no,
I love that.
The streams there.
I love
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I think it's cool.
So I, as you may know, I spent a lot of money on a Surface Studio, the new Microsoft desktop, and I'm blown away by it. It is wonderful to play with. It really, what you're spending $3,000, that's the base model for, is a 28-inch P3 4500 by 3000 screen. And just a gorgeous screen. It's attached to a little box that contains a fairly crappy computer. I mean, let's face it. They didn't put a lot of hardware in there. It's basically a laptop with an i5. It has 8 gigabytes of RAM in the base model soldered into the motherboard, so you can't expand it. But we found out there is something you can do. And I gave it to Father Robert, put it in his capable hands, knowing that his primary directive is do no evil, to see if he could speed it up. Watch.
Have you gotten yourself a brand spanking new Microsoft Surface Studio with its beautiful screen and impressive list of features, but found the performance to be a little wanting? If so, you're in luck, because the problem is most likely the slow storage subsystem. And believe it or not, that is upgradable. We're going to upgrade our baseline Surface Studio, replacing the existing 64GB M.2 cache SSD with a 250GB Samsung 850 EVO M.2 card, and the 1TB rotating drive with a 960GB Kingston UV400 2.5-inch SSD. This assembly starts by removing the 4 rubber feet on the underside of the Studio in order to access the 4 torque screws underneath. With the screws out, a gentle tug on the cover with some suction cups gives you access to the midframe and cooling fans. Removing 5 torque screws unmounts the fans, and an additional 8 screws need to be removed to pull free the midframe so the fan connectors can be removed from the motherboard. With the midframe removed, you now have access to the M.2 bay. In our baseline Surface Studio, a 64GB SanDisk SSD is mounted in a standard socket that will work with any 80mm M.2 card. Remove the existing card, replace it with your upgrade, then replace the torque screw to complete the M.2 upgrade. You could stop there and run the OS and programs on the 250GB Samsung Evo, but this is Leo's computer, and we want fast data storage as well, so we need to remove the cooling system to get access to the SATA bay. There are a total of 7 torque screws and 1 mounting post that hold the cooling array to the motherboard. After unscrewing them and an additional hex mounting post above the secondary heatsink, you can pry loose the cooling assembly from the CPU and GPU. Remove the 3 remaining torque screws to free the hard drive frame, then remove the frame from the drive and reattach it to your upgrade SSD. Now, it's just a matter of putting everything back where we found it. Connect the SATA data and power connectors to your 2.5-inch SSD and use 3 torque screws to attach the assembly to the motherboard. Hold the cooling assembly in place, then refasten the 4 spring-loaded torque screws on the center plate, tightening each in a criss-cross pattern. Resecure the cooling assembly to the processor with 3 torque screws, then replace the mounting post above the primary and secondary heatsinks. Reconnect the fans to the motherboard, then push the fans through the midframe and snap it back into place. Reconnect the speaker connector, then secure the fans with torque screws and replace the 8 screws that hold the midframe. Replace the cover and use the remaining 4 torque screws to secure it before covering each of the recessed mounts with a rubber foot. We removed all storage, so we need to boot from recovery media. We put ours on a USB 3.0 drive, so a full reinstall was done in about 10 minutes. Now, on to the benchmarking. The original setup was not good, averaging about 100 megabytes per second read and 90 megabytes per second write in the 50 megabyte file test. That did improve as we increased the file size, but it was still far, far slower than even a budget SSD, and the write score never really improved. With our newly upgraded Surface Studio, we benched about 540 megabytes per second read and 500 megabytes per second write. In other words, if you want performance, it's time to upgrade. It should be noted that we could have gone much crazier and much more expensive with our upgrade by getting a much faster M.2 part, perhaps giving us a transfer rate of 2,000 megabytes per second or more. But with an i5 processor and 8 gigabytes of memory, it didn't really seem to suit the package. Now, if you want the step-by-step instructions and the full video for this upgrade, be sure to watch episode 270 of Know How at twit.tv/KH.
So Father Robert says there was 32 screws holding that thing together, 173 steps to take it apart. They buried the spinning drive under the cooling subsystem. It's like at the bottom of the thing. So it isn't something you might want to do at home. However, the good news is it doesn't necessarily, I mean, technically it probably voids the warranty, but there's none of those stickers or weird screws.
You have to heat up with the heat gun.
So we saved the old drives, and if worse came to worse, I'm pretty sure we could put the old drives back in and take it to Microsoft and get the thing replaced. Made a huge difference in performance. And the thing that's kind of, this is the little laptop-y computer underneath. You can see it's not very big. The kind of surprising thing is that Microsoft's selling this computer at such a high price with kind of an anemic PC behind it that people have asked him, well, gosh, couldn't you just sell the screen? You know, the angle is what makes this really interesting, a 20-degree angle. Couldn't you just sell that and have and the base but not put a computer in it and have somebody use their own computer? Microsoft says, no, we're not going to sell the screen by itself. Even the top of the line, which is an i7 and 32 gigs of RAM and costs $4,000, still has a very slow SATA 2 drive in a SATA 3 bay running at 5,400 RPM. So in no case is the storage fast, even at the $4,000 price range. I love this so much, I almost bought one for my home. And then I thought, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to wait. Because Microsoft has a history of doing this in six months or maybe a year, upgrading it to a much faster
machine.
Coming
out with a newer model,
Yeah.
This that almost definitely boggles needs to the mind, though. You know, if you're gonna put something like this out at that price point, I mean, it better run everything. It better have the latest and greatest. I mean, it's kind of crazy that they don't...
look at that. Two terabytes of slow storage, an i7, 32 gigabytes, $4,199.
Wow.
And I got to say, I think the better deal is to get the lower end one and do what we did, which, how much did that cost, Robert? Maybe $700 for the new drive, something
A total of $300.
$300 for the new drive. Because at first we were looking at, well, let's get an Evo 950, get the top of the line M.2 NVMe SSD. And then I said, well, as Father Robert said in the piece, it doesn't make a lot of sense with an i5 and 8 gigs of RAM to max that out. I'm very happy now. I feel like this is a fairly balanced machine. It runs snappily. It does everything I want it to do. And the real deal on this is the screen, the pen, the dial. It really is a wonderful thing to work with. So I think for that price, I think I'm pretty happy with what we got instead of spending $4,199. Thank you, Father Robert. He suggested this. And for the full details, walk through the whole thing, watch Know How. Is it going to be this week? Monday's Know How. And you'll be able to see everything.
And how many screws did you have left over when you got done? You
said it started with 32.
Yeah. Always extra parts.
You know what? It's not going to fall apart. I wouldn't even put them all back in.
That's what I always do. I get down at the end and I look down at the desk.
I know there's going to
Where'd that screw go?
Somewhere. Hey, you want to do a call for help?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sounds
good.
I love it. I think this is the most distant call for help we've done to date from Hyderabad, India. Mustafa's on the line. Hi, Mustafa!
Hello, how are you doing?
It's so great to see you. Do you watch this show?
No, I use the podcast version.
You listen.
Yeah, I listen.
All right, right on. Are you a student?
No, I'm working as a software engineer.
Nice. What kind of stuff do you write?
I primarily work on Android apps. I am a Google developer expert for Android as well.
Fun.
Great.
And you do it for contract or do you do it for yourself?
No, I work for a company. I lead their engineering team in India.
Very exciting. Well, what can we do to help you?
Well, I've been looking for a way to automate the backup of my Google account. Basically, all my email, photos, drive content. I want to make sure that, let's say, if my account gets hacked, I don't lose everything. Or Google one fine day decides to just suspend my account or anything like that. I just don't lose all my stuff.
Well, you know about takeout, obviously.
Yep. So it's a one-time thing. I can't keep doing it always.
Yeah, no, of course not.
You don't get incremental backups.
In fact, even the name kind of implies what takeout's all about, which is getting out of the Google ecosystem, getting all my data so I can say goodbye and go somewhere else. But, by the way, credit to Google for offering that. That is unique, as far as I know, among cloud services, where they just one place you go, takeout.google.com, and you can download and export data from every single Google app and save it somewhere, and usually it's in an XML format. Okay, so that's, I mean, I guess you could write a script that would do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, you could script it. Well, what a bummer. You don't want to do that. And I think you mentioned you've tried something already. Is that right? You've tried or heard about something that you thought about using?
Yeah, based on my research, there's something called Spin Backup that claims to do what I need, but I couldn't find any good reviews of them online. Since it will have all my content, I just want to be sure that, you know, all my data is secure and people are not, like, snooping in on it.
See, that's why I'd almost prefer to use something like Takeout and save it locally.
Save it yourself.
And just make a script that it's got to be scriptable.
Put it in your Nextcloud. We talked about running cloud services at home.
Well, exactly.
Put it in your
Nextcloud. Yeah,
cloud.
Or put it on my Synology. That would be awesome. For Google Drive alone, you said you wanted Gmail and everything else, but for Google Drive alone, Google does have a sync tool that kind of works like Dropbox. Yep. It makes a local copy. Mm-hmm. It synchronizes your local copy with the cloud. I do run that.
I do too.
Yeah, and in fact,
and they have the same thing for photos.
Right.
Upload your photos automatically.
Right. Yeah, you could save them. In fact, the Synology cloud that I use will automatically do that, run Google Drive, and do it for Dropbox too, and keep a local copy of that. Yep. But you want Gmail. Boy, I used to use a service called Backupify. Yep. This was a really cool service when they launched, and I was an early user. They backed up everything. They backed up my Yahoo accounts. They backed up everything. They got purchased by a company called Datto. They went kind of enterprise-focused, and as you can see, even the name Backupify for Google Apps kind of implies that it's for the business.
Enterprise users.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, this is tough. The tough thing about this is that he wants everything, right? He wants the kitchen sink, and there's lots of apps out there that'll do it. Cloud HQ is another option to take a look at. But the one that I've heard the most good things about actually is this one, Spin Backup. Hmm. And the reviews that I've been able to find actually are, you know, people are quite pleased with it because it does just what you want. Most of the other apps, we'll back up your email and maybe Google Drive, and that's it.
But, you know, especially in light of this Evernote story and the Yahoo hack, I really understand why you're nervous. I mean, first of all, I guess we trust Google, right? You're an Android developer. I guess we trust Google, so they got my data. But then to give that whole set of data unencrypted to another party that you never heard of, that would make me nervous too, Mustafa. Yep. So I guess what I would say is I think the safest thing is for you to back it up locally on your own servers. You know, use a NAS. Synology, something like that, back it up in your own servers. And I don't know how scriptable Takeout is, but I've got to think, I mean, it's a website that there's a way you could, at the worst case scenario, just write a scraper that would go there once a week and just download everything. Yep. You can't do incremental. You know, you're going to be downloading everything each time. Google should offer a solution.
They should offer a solution that's differential, right? They should offer a delta option.
Wouldn't that be nice?
So that you're only downloading what's changed, because that's got to be 1%. You know, if I do it every week, there's not more than 1% or even 0.05% that's changing every week. So they should offer that service where you can just get the deltas, and that would solve this problem for most people, I think.
Or, you know, if they just supported rsync.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was just thinking.
If they just supported rsync. So, because the way this works when you download your data is you create an archive. Mm-hmm. You have checkboxes, and you choose all the services, and it creates an archive on their drive, which you could then download. If they would just offer an rsync button to that, that would be very simple, right? Then it would really, truly be scriptable. All right. We have to talk to, is it Brad Fitzpatrick who does this? I think it is. We have to talk to Brad Fitzpatrick. He's very proud of this. I mean, he should be. This is, in a way, this is why I trust Google, because they give you this access to your data. Same thing with the dashboard and the new My Activity thing. They at least let you see what they know, what they've collected, and press a button to delete it or press a button to take it home with you.
And they've been very consistent about this over the years. I just ran – the other day I was looking for something in my drive, and I ran into my – what was it? Google Buzz? What was that?
Buzz. Yeah, remember that?
I came up with a directory, and it said, oh, this is my Google Buzz backup.
Oh, your
backup.
Buzz data.
Yeah. I was like,
still there. Wow. I'm looking in the chat room to see if they know anything, Mustafa, because that's one of the great assets we have. It's not just us, the two of us, but we have a great production staff. They've been looking all week, and we have 1,000 people or something like that in the chat room who are thinking about this. I don't have an answer for you, and I think you're right. As spin backup might be great, but you know, read the terms of service. It's clearly their employees have access to the data. It's not encrypted. Because you're not doing your own encryption before it goes to spin backup with your own key.
Right.
So it's a risky proposition at best, you know. I just I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say.
Take out if you're paranoid.
Well, that's the other thing.
Maybe if you're
or do your own cloud.
Or run your own cloud.
Run your own cloud. I mean, Nextcloud or OwnCloud or Synology can do – Synology has Office apps. They have many of the same things that Google offers. I think ultimately many of us are starting to move in that direction, that I just want to do my own cloud. I was using Sandstorm for a while, which is a really cool security-first local storage solution that gives you a lot of the same features. You know, I stopped using GitHub. I'm using my own Git server. I think that in some ways, that's where we're going, right, Mustafa, is... I think I'm just going to keep it in my on premises, and then they'll have to raid my house if they want to get my stuff, right? Which,
one of the things I was thinking was I can have a local copy of all my stuff in my house, and then I can write a script to just back it up in an encrypted way in an AWS bucket sitting somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah, that I can have redundancy there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now that's totally doable because once you have it. You can do what Steve Gibson calls P or Pi, pre-internet encryption or pre-egress encryption.
Encrypt it yourself.
And once you pee on it, then you can give it to anybody because they can't get to it, right?
Yep.
Pre-egress encryption. We changed it to Pi a little later because it didn't make a. It was somebody didn't want to do that. Thank you, Mustafa. I know we weren't much help, but hey, it's really nice to know you listen, and thank you for joining us. Come back again soon, okay?
Sure.
Take care. Thank you. Wow, if you want to be on the show, here's how you can do it. Ask a question. Watch.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
So how many different mesh router solutions are there? Eero kind of was the first one that now had Google Wi-Fi. There was Plume. There was Luma. Ubiquiti, which kind of did it in the enterprise first, right? Now has their Amplify. I've ordered one of those because I want to try those. There's so many. There's one we haven't tried yet. But fortunately, Jason Howell has. Here's Jason with his review of the Almond 3 smart home Wi-Fi system. Watch.
Hey, I'm here with the Almond 3 smart home Wi-Fi system. This, as you can see right out on the table, this is the whole kit. Basically, it's all revolving around this. This is the Almond 3 itself. For $149.99, you can get one router, or you can get the 3-pack because it's a mesh router connected system. It's about $400. All these sensors that you see here, they're all Zigbee sensors. Those are all separate, and they range in price from, you know, this little window or door sensor is right around $30. This motion sensor is right around $40. So right around in there, $20 to $40. All of this can connect to the Almond 3 router, as you see here. Now, one thing that I actually really liked about this, you can see the screen on here. This really sets it apart. You can do it inside on the screen here. Yes, it includes a stylus because it's a resistive screen here. And you can do all of the settings that you need to from the screen itself. So that kind of helps you kind of move through the process a little bit quicker. And then you can also set it up so that it displays the weather or displays the time when it's not in use. I mean, I just kind of let it time out when I wasn't using it because it's just sitting on a counter somewhere doing its job, basically. So it's a 1 gigabit in, you can see, and then 2 out, 802.11bgn and AC. There's also a USB port if you need to use that for anything. I'd say it's a nice, attractive, minimalist design compared to other routers that I've had in my lifetime. This one just kind of sits up, you know, nicely in the background and kind of blends in with things. And setup was super easy. I think that's one of the key points here is that, especially in the mesh world, mesh can be kind of complicated to set up. Thankfully, it was actually relatively simple to set it up. They walk you through it with the app on the phone, and that allows you to kind of get things all connected and running. Now, there is an app, like I said, it's the Almond app here. I'll go ahead and pull this up here really quick. And you can see right here, this is the screen I just left it on. You can create rules. So that's kind of one of the benefits of this with IoT devices, that you can set up a rule so that if something happens, a condition happens, then these other things happen. So for example, I could set it up so that when I connect this phone to the Wi-Fi hub, when I get home, this peanut plug would actually activate power to my Christmas lights outside. So if it was after 6 p.m., let's say, and I connect to Wi-Fi, the peanut plug would activate, my Christmas lights would go on. I got to tell you, some of that automation stuff with these plugs and some of these sensors was so much fun. It was really nice to get in there and just kind of get nerdy with some of the features. But I mean, you've got a whole dashboard for controlling the Wi-Fi from your phone, setting it into away mode, creating scenes, which are basically like one button that controls a bunch of different facets throughout your connected home. Really cool stuff, really similar to If This Then That for connected devices, and very powerful. As for performance, I mean, that's really what it boils down to, right? Mesh is supposed to distribute internet throughout your home equally. And I would say that the mesh, in my experience, wasn't always super reliable. I would lose connection when I was going between one point to another point. And I would really hope for that to be a little more stable than I found it to be. Yes, the screen is nice. I wish that you could totally lock it so that, you know, kids wouldn't be tempted to get in there and touch the touch screen and play around with it. But regardless, very cool product. It's easy. It looks nice. It's convenient compared to other routers that I've used. Like I said, mesh and roaming wasn't dependable. And so if that's really important to you, I'd say at least do your research before you go in. Though the Internet of Things capabilities here are a huge reason why I would recommend this. You're going to spend more for hubs to do this anyways, so the cost difference is really kind of minimal when you're talking about getting the mesh network set up with the Almond 3 and using it to power your smart home. I'm really going to miss the Internet of Things connectivity of the Almond 3 in my home. I got really used to turning off the outdoor Christmas lights from my phone instead of having to go out into the garage and do it where it's freezing cold, like a chump. You can catch me on the other shows in the Twit Network, Tech News Today, all about Android and Android App Arena. Thanks for watching.
Well, kind of this, it's interesting. So this, the focus of the Almond is home automation. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would have thought Google would have done with Google Wi-Fi. Right. Isn't that what we thought they were going to do with the hub?
Yes, with the hub. It's exactly what I was thinking. The hub had great promise, right? And then you think, oh, you get the hub, you get the Nest.
Yeah.
You know, you've got all these things.
And they never did it.
They never did it. They haven't done it yet. Yeah. I think that's why, you know, with them renaming the app Home and all that kind of stuff, I think they're going to get there.
Yeah.
At least I hope they do.
Well, I always look to you because I have all that stuff, and I noticed when we moved, I didn't install the Nest, I didn't install the Hue, I didn't set up the smart things. It's a lot of work.
It is.
So I'm going to let you do it, and you let
I'll
me
let
know
you
when
know.
It. You let me know when it's all working.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Time for the mailbag, or in this case, come on, Tanya. Come
there
on. Didn't Jerry give you mailbag lessons? This is the mailbox, the Screensaver's mailbox. Doesn't roll like it used to. Pick an email, any email. You take one, I'll take one. It doesn't matter, truthfully. It's,
I feel like I'm going to win a prize or something.
I get to start. Number one from Reggae G, who says, hey, man, I run Thunderbird using Pop. Well, there you go. You got a problem right there. On Ubuntu with Gmail. Lately, I've been getting hints from Gmail. They do not want to support Thunderbird for reasons of security. I don't want to switch to IMAP. Now that Microsoft has joined the Linux Foundation, I was hoping Outlook would soon be running on Linux. But in the meantime, I'm looking for a more secure, according to Gmail, application to run Pop on my Ubuntu desktop. Any suggestions? Keep up the good work. Been a follower since the early 90s. Reggae G. So, first of all, why
Pop? It
sounds
like Reggae's a little bit mixed up.
Yeah.
No offense, Reggae, but I mean, you know, he's hoping that Microsoft's going to bring Outlook to Linux.
That's not going to happen.
I don't know. It just seems a little bit. I wouldn't go that direction at all. I mean, what do you think, Leo?
Well, first of all, I'm not a fan of Outlook because it's all mushed together into one giant PST file, a calendar, address book, and email. It's somewhat proprietary. It's really designed to work best with Microsoft's own Exchange server. Google supports its own flavor of IMAP. Mm-hmm. I use Thunderbird all the time. I haven't seen any warnings.
I haven't seen any warnings yet or heard about any warnings.
Now, remember, the Thunderbird project is somewhat orphaned, right?
Right.
It was a part of the Mozilla project, and they decided not to continue development. Mm-hmm. Has it been forked or has somebody taken it over? I don't know.
I haven't heard.
Yeah.
But there's also Evolution. Which could be...
Yeah, Evolution is another example of a dying
It's kind of dying off, project. But it does have better integration with things like Exchange servers.
It looks more like Outlook, frankly.
It looks more like Outlook. Yeah. So that's another thing you could try. But I'm guessing that if Gmail is complaining about Thunderbird, either A, it's not completely up to date, or B, you're not going to find anything better to run under Ubuntu unless you just go to the web. Just run the web client.
Right.
That's what I do. I don't depend on a standalone email client on my servers because I'm moving around from computer to computer all the time.
Right.
So just if you're really worried about it, just run the web app and be done with it.
I'll tell you why I use Thunderbird because of the plugins. I use Thunderbird with Gmail with IMAP. Which I would prefer over Pop. That may be what they're saying to you is don't use Pop.
Yep.
I use the Lightning Connect extension, which allows me to do calendaring.
Yep.
It's not perfect. It's sluggish, and I keep getting JavaScript timeouts. Mm-hmm. But it's there, which is nice, and it syncs with my Google Calendar. And then I also, and I love it, use the Enigmail extension because I'm a believer in GPG, and GPG is the GNU Privacy Guard. It's the open source version of PGP encryption for your email. Yeah. And I sign every message with a PGP key. I encourage people to send me encrypted email, and I will send you encrypted email back. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm doing anything private, because I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I think the more of us that use encrypted email, the better it is for everybody.
Yeah.
And it really is about privacy. So between Enigmail, Lightning, and then I use there's a calendar for Google provider that does the interchange.
Yep.
Into Lightning. So those three extensions on Thunderbird, pretty much a perfect email setup. I understand it feels a little orphaned. It feels a little edgy, and I don't know if there's anything better.
I don't
tried
think
a
there's
lot of
anything
things,
better.
That given was that that's what I want to do.
And that was exactly my setup when I worked at Sun. I was using everything that you just described, and it worked perfectly. I can't think of it, but there are plenty of other Pop email providers out there. A simple Google search will bring up probably 6 or 7 that you can use, but I don't
Pop's
think there's any
antiquated.
So that's number
IMAP.
One. Yeah. I don't know why you don't like. I would use IMAP first.
It's a more modern protocol.
Maybe that's like you said. Maybe that's the warning, and then otherwise, I would stick with Thunderbird and just make sure it's updated. You know, go out and run apt-get update or whatever you use.
And the next time you're on Floss Weekly, would you please ask the Floss community? What's going on? Why don't we have better email clients?
Absolutely.
You know, there's some people really like the email client that comes with the Evolution OS, which is kind of a modified version, I think, of the whose client is it? It's one of the, but it's very simple. And and here's the key: it doesn't support GPG. If it doesn't support GPG, I'm not going to use it. I feel like there needs to, but obviously, Reggae, you don't care about that, probably. So there are other. What is the mail client? I think it's the GNOME mail client. I'm not sure.
Could be.
But Elementary OS has a very nice... By the way, look at Elementary OS because that is a version of Linux that is... It's based on Ubuntu, but it's very clean, very beautiful. And it's a very nice email client on it. What's the name of it? I can't remember the name of their email client. It's good, though. It's right there. What is it? Mail. There's a name. I don't know why I don't remember that. Click on the mail because it's kind of a fork of a well-known. Yeah, see, they don't give credit to the original project. But look at that. That's clean. That's
simple,
easy.
Simple, easy to use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good choice. You can override Google's blocking less secure clients. There is a fix for that. Thank you, Knox Harrington, in our chat room. Is Thunderbird less secure now? Boy, that's disappointing if it is.
Well, like I said, it could. If it's an older version, it could be. It could be missing
some
patches.
Get the latest version.
Get the latest version and see if that fixes it.
Yeah. What do you got? You have a message there.
Here is my message. It says, hello. Always a good way to start. I found that Linux applications. I found that Linux applications can run on Chromebooks on the Chromium site. In particular, I talked about
Crouton.
Crouton and Krubuntu. The info seemed a bit confusing, and a lot of it is dated. I wanted to be able to keep the Chrome interface, be able to run Linux applications, and not break anything in the process. That'd be nice. I would greatly appreciate help and information on this matter and would like to see a Chromebook successfully running some kind of Linux, if possible. And this is from Zach. So thank you, Zach, for that question. This is a little bit of a tough one, too. My initial thought was to recommend Crouton.
I've used Crouton, yeah.
But if Crouton is too complicated, then it gets a little tough. There is something called Roll App. I don't know if you've seen Roll App. And that combines running apps in the cloud or uses a cloud functionality to run Linux apps and present them on your Chromebook. So if you really want to get those Linux apps, and it doesn't say which Linux apps in here, so I'm not sure. Maybe it's Thunderbird. If you really want to get those Linux apps on your Chromebook, I would check out, and you don't like those other methods, check out Roll App and see if that solves the problem for you. But I agree, it can be complicated. I mean, the Chromebooks really weren't designed to run native Linux. Even though it's possible, it's like kind of a little bit of a workaround to get that going.
Well, and you also have to reduce security. You have to turn off secure boot.
Yep.
And to me, that's the biggest negative.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little janky, too. And I'm trying to remember. I've used Crouton as a kind of standalone. Will the Linux apps run next to Chrome apps? They will.
They will, yep.
So you at least get that benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But you lose security. It is hard to do. Although, if you follow the steps, I would look at Crouton. If you follow the steps, you know, you don't have to know what you're doing. If you follow the steps carefully, it's a cookbook.
Yeah, yeah, there is. And there's some really good walkthrough tutorials out there if you just search for Crouton or search for Ubuntu on Chromebook. And that'll lead you to a couple of really good tutorials.
By the way, you don't have to, although I'd recommend it, you don't have to use Ubuntu. You can use a number of other Linuxes on the Chromebook. It's just, it's frustrating because the Chromebook is Linux.
Yep.
But they have locked it down, and that's really the point of a Chromebook, is a safe to use, kind of easy to use with Linux under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to hybridize it a little bit.
And,
of course that's hard to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's the ideal. You must have an old laptop lying around. Put Ubuntu on it.
Exactly, yeah. Just go find an old laptop.
The one thing that's really made it easy to use Linux these days is you get Chromium, which is the open source version of Chrome. It's identical to Chrome, runs all the Chrome extensions. It does all the syncing. It is Chrome.
It is.
They just call it Chromium. And at that point, you are basically, you can use Chrome, but I prefer to use Chromium. You literally can install Chrome on most Linuxes.
I use Chrome.
Yeah. Why not Chromium?
I had some problems with Chromium early on.
Yeah, I use Chromium.
But anyway.
It doesn't matter. It's the same code base. There's things in Chrome that aren't in Chromium.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, you kind of have what you want, which is a Chromebook, that's the Chrome window, and Linux running in the background.
Right. And you sign in, you get all your extensions, everything syncs to
without compromising security.
Without compromising security. Yeah. I totally agree with that suggestion. If you've got an old laptop, my parents keep getting new laptops. They're upwards in age, and every 2 or 3 years they get a new one because they can't connect to Wi-Fi or something. They're like, here, take my old laptop. I got a new one. That's not how they talk. But so I get these old laptops, and the first thing I do is I install, Linux Mint or something on them, and good to go.
Easy, fast. Linux has gotten, frankly, Linux on the desktop is very mature now, very easy to use.
Yeah.
Bill in Michigan says he likes Claws Mail for an email client.
Interesting.
I haven't used Claws Mail. Truthfully, I often use Mutt. Don't tell anybody.
Why
it's
not?
It's command line based.
Yeah.
Works well with Pop or IMAP.
Mm-hmm.
And, It's very easy. You write your email in Emacs. It's very fast. You just use the arrow keys. Very quick. Boom, boom, boom. Space bar arrow keys. Boom, 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 boom. But probably not the easiest.
That's for the hardcore
user.
Yeah. Linux user especially.
Yeah. Actually, it took me a while to get it working. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'd recommend that. Well, there we go.
There we go.
We have completed another new Screensavers. I always love having you come in here. Keep coming, will you?
Thanks for having me. Absolutely.
You're
I'm
the greatest.
Glad
Aaron
to come.
Newcomb, Benicia Makerspace.
Benicia Makerspace.
You're working on a book for Make Magazine. That's exciting.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. So that one's coming along with, like I said, it should be out in the spring if I can keep, you know, keep my nose to the grindstone on that. And then, you know, coming not too far away is Benicia Mini Maker Faire. Again, for people that live locally or semi-locally, regionally in Northern California, April 2nd, we just agreed on the date, is going to be Benicia Mini Maker Faire. Nice. In fact, I think I'm going to get those guys that did the lightsaber training. I'm going to see if they can come up and do a demo for everybody that comes to the Maker Faire. That would be great.
Next week is Christmas Eve. Mm. Now, I know we have a toasty fire and decorations, but I don't think we're going to do the show next week, are we?
No.
It's not the best of, though. Is it just going to no show? Because the best of will be New Year's Eve, I think. Well, we haven't figured that out yet. Right. So we're going to be gone 2 weeks. I will not be back here until January 7th.
Wow.
So I hope you have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just enjoy the heck out of your family and friends. Don't boot up the computer. Now, if you haven't finished your Christmas shopping or your Hanukkah shopping, I do have a suggestion for you. We have created a store. But due to popular demand, it's kind of not, it's limited merchandise right now. But check it out. Teespring, T-E-E, spring.com/stores/twit. Or, you know what, the short URL is better. twit.to/store. twit.to. Like go to twit.to/store. And we're going to put more stuff in there, but probably not before the holidays. But eventually we'll get, you know, other fun stuff in there. But those are some of the best designs.
Nice looking T-shirts.
Yeah,
wow.
Those are some of our best designs. Anthony did like 3/4 of them. He's a good designer, including that Air Force T-shirt.
I like that one. That's cool.
I know. That's my favorite. We just completed the campaign for that. And if you bought it during the campaign, don't feel bad. Because you got a deal, because we have to charge a little bit more for these, because it's print. It's now print on demand instead of printing a whole batch at once. So it's a little bit more expensive. Got the hoodie, got the ladies' fitted tee, long sleeve tee. I like that. I sleep in that. It's very toasty. Those are my jammies right there. I said, Lisa, move over. The Air Force is coming. Here we come. What else? No point in doing the best of. I'm sure we're done with that, right? Yeah, we got all our clips for the best of. Unless you find a good one, go to twit.tv/best of. You can sneak it in under the wire. We have a full week of shows, though, right up until next Saturday. So we'll be here right through Friday doing shows and having fun. But since I'm not going to see you again on the new Screensavers, have a wonderful couple of weeks. And I'll see you 2017. Thanks for joining us. See you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.